A very warm welcome to the next instalment of the North of Scotland Parkinson's Research Interest Group podcast. So today's podcast is going to take a slightly different slant and slightly more clinically focused due to popular demand. So today we're going to be talking about all things deep brain stimulation. And this has in part been motivated by the fantastic documentary that was put on Parkinson's UK in relation to Jo Tosh, or previously known as Jo Yaldren's, experiences that she had from going through deep brain stimulation. So today we've very much got a Scottish expert in Dr. Ed Newman, who's going to talk to us about deep brain stimulation, what it is, how it works, and what are the benefits of deep brain stimulation for some people with Parkinson's. As usual, I'm here with my co-pilot, Helga, and she's going to hold the fort today and ask all the questions, so I'm going to have to be on my best behaviour to try not interrupt. I do hope you enjoy this podcast, and if anybody's got any suggestions as to who else they would like to hear on the podcast, please do get in contact with us, and our contact details are on the narrative just below this podcast, so do get in touch. I hope you enjoy this podcast. Bye.
Hello, and welcome to this month's Parkinson's Research Podcast. Consultant neurologist from Glasgow, Dr. Ed Newman, is also from the Institute of Neurological Sciences at the Queen Elizabeth University Hospital in Glasgow and the National Deep Brain Stimulation Service, which is the topic for our conversation today. So, hello, Ed.
Hello, Helga.
We have a special thank you to you for joining us today, because I noticed on an email responder that you're doing it on holiday. So we're very grateful to you for breaking into your holiday to talk to us this morning.
Not at all. And thanks very much for inviting me on to speak.
Deep brain stimulation sounds extremely high tech, but it's not brand new by any means, is it? It's been on the go for about 20 years or so. It's not brand new by any means.
That's right. Probably a bit more than that. In from the early 90s, it got going as a recognised treatment for Parkinson's disease, but also for a few other movement disorders, for tremor and dystonia. And essentially, in deep brain stimulation surgery, it's an evolution of other surgical practices that have existed for decades, going further back. Actually, for tremor in particular, we were doing surgery before there was medications available to treat it in Parkinson's disease. In the case of DBS, what happens? It's a surgical procedure. What it involves is two electrodes being placed into a very deep nucleus in the brain, and then being wired to a battery or pacemaker, a bit of equipment that sits in the anterior chest wall. And over time, patients get their stimulator adjusted for right levels of stimulation to improve their symptoms of Parkinson's disease.
How common is it amongst Parkinson's sufferers? I mean, what percentage of people do you know have got it in Scotland?
You know, I mean, it varies a little bit across across different places in the world and across the UK as well. It's probably around 15% of patients who have Parkinson's disease at some point in their disease course will be eligible for DBS. But actually, the uptake of DBS will vary according to, there's lots of other factors that influence that. But it's not suitable for all patients with Parkinson's disease for reasons I imagine that we'll come on to a bit later on. But it's somewhere in that ballpark, maybe 15, perhaps up to 20% of patients.
Has it changed a lot over the years that it has been done from, over the last 20 plus years? Has it changed much in that time?
Yeah, it has. It's been a fairly sort of incremental change that we've seen to the technology with time. I think that the things that have changed are throughout the process of DBS. So in terms of the investigation, the patient selection aspect, so it's recognizing which are the right patients who are going to most likely benefit from the treatment, and the tests that we put those patients through. There are aspects of the surgical technique that's changed with time, including uses of image guidance to improve the accuracy of placement of the leads, using robots in theatre, the way in which we wake patients up or don't wake patients up in terms of what they have intraoperatively. And there's changes in the hardware as well. So the batteries that we were implanting 20 years ago look quite different from what the current batteries do what they're capable in terms of how long they last. Also, the electrodes that we that are passed into the brain themselves. We used to have four contacts, and now we have lots many more contacts than that in these segmented leads. So actually, whilst the process is the same, the individual components have changed with time, and as has the programming, and the patients will get slightly better outcomes with each of these improvements.
I know with heart pacemakers and things, there are different kinds and different makes and things like that. Are there different devices that different people with Parkinson's get?
Okay, so there are three manufacturers for DBS systems available in the UK. The most and actually the manufacturers who make pacemaker technology, you know, they're the same companies that make pacemakers as make DBS systems. So the three companies are Medtronic, Boston Scientific, and Abbott, and they offer slightly different things. You have some systems that are rechargeable, so you have the operation done with the IPG that sits in the chest wall, and once it's switched on and programmed, then the patient will recharge that device. Patients will vary from how frequently they do it, but they might do it, say, twice a week, just an hour in front of the TV or reading a book, where they have a sort of thing that sits over their IPG and charges it up. So that's the first difference. You get the primary cell, so against the rechargeable. And the rechargeable devices now are probably will last the patient 15 or 20 years. But you are required to you're committed to recharge it twice a week. Otherwise, it will go. You know, the battery will die. Whereas the primary cell, depending on what your settings are, might last 3 to 5 years. And you don't have to touch it in the meantime. You don't have to recharge it. But over 20 years, someone might be having three battery replacements, and another patient might be having one. So that's one choice. Some of the new batteries, new IPGs offer remote programming as well. So this is something that we've started in Scotland. Actually, we're the first in the UK to get this up and running, where we can connect with patients who live far away from our DBS centre in Glasgow, and make check their system, make adjustments to their stimulation, and link with them via their patient controller, via a kind of a similar interface that we're using now, a kind of like a online Zoom type technology. And the other thing that I mentioned briefly earlier on was we now have what we call directional programming, where we can take within the electrode leads. Previously, we had just single leads that were kind of circular and created a field of tissue activation that was like a sphere around that contact. And now we can push that stimulation towards an area of where they're getting good clinical benefit, and more importantly, away from a further area where they might be experiencing some side effects.
Quite remarkable that you can make changes remotely. Quite amazing, and particularly applicable in Scotland too. You mentioned there are certain criteria that, you know, makes people more or less suitable for DBS. What are they? And as the technology progresses, is that also progressing, the type and number of people who are suitable for this?
I think with time we've honed down who tends to do better in the longer term with a procedure like this. And bear in mind, I think if you are putting someone through the pre-surgical workup, the surgery itself and the programming phase, you want them to have a good few years of good benefit from a device like this. It's a big thing for any patient to undergo. So patient selection, I think we've got a little bit better with that as time goes on. But essentially, in Parkinson's disease, and I'm this is not meant as an exhaustive list, because some other things will come to me kind of later. But if there are a couple of instances where DBS is helpful. There's usually, the most common indication is in advanced Parkinson's disease, where you have motor fluctuations. And in motor fluctuations, you get your on and your off phase. And if patients are experiencing prolonged off phases, but when they take the tablets, when they take the levodopa, they are experiencing on periods with good function. What DBS can do for that patient group is it can reduce the amount of time they spend in an off state, and hopefully maintain them in an on state, preferably with minimizing their or reducing their dyskinesias if that's possible. That's partially because we're able to, once we start that stimulation, it has a similar effect as their levodopa tablets, but it's a continuous thing that they're having. And it allows us to reduce their levodopa dose overall. And it's probably the drugs that, in combination with the underlying Parkinson's disease, that cause those fluctuations. The other scenario in Parkinson's disease, slightly less common for us to do, but we absolutely do it, is where someone has a tremor that is unresponsive to medications. So it doesn't matter how high you push the levodopa or other dopaminergic medication, the tremor is not improving. So there are targets in with DBS that we'll be able to get a good tremor response, for those cases.
It all sounds incredibly complicated, but quite simply, how does it actually work? What does it actually do that helps the Parkinson's?
I think the more complicated this becomes, the more you go into it, the more complicated this area is. But essentially, in Parkinson's disease, in some of the circuits in the basal ganglia, they respond badly to the loss of dopaminergic cells and the lack of activity from those cells. And it's the compensation that you get within the substantia nigra that causes this disruption. And if you pass an electrode and override that and continue that stimulation, particularly in the subthalamic nucleus, you can override that abnormal activity and bring and kind of partially regulate that system. You can really go into this in a lot of detail, but it's not something I think that the patients or necessarily the clinicians tend to dwell on too much. We try and keep it simple with increased stimulation kind of improves the symptoms or has this effect, or reducing the stimulation has the alternate effect.
In that case, do people with different Parkinson's symptoms, do you pinpoint different areas of the brain?
So there are different targets for different indications in DBS. So in Parkinson's disease, the commonest target for us to use is the subthalamic nucleus. So if the symptoms are primarily bradykinesia, the off symptoms of Parkinson's, then that's the target that we would use. If the symptoms are more for dystonia and tremor, we have different targets. We can have a thalamic target targeting VIM, or we can target the GPI in the case of dystonia. There are different centres around the UK that might do a GPI target for a specific problem in Parkinson's disease, and there are or you could even target just have the tremor target of VIM if you like. So we look at these cases individually, but the majority of the time we will go for subthalamic nucleus in Glasgow as our target for Parkinson's patients. We have each patient that we see and assess. We spend a lot of time working them up, and every decision about whether to go forward with surgery and how to interpret the results of their investigations. We look at all of this in the round, and as an MDT decide what the best target is, and who the suitable cases are. And then with the patient, we'll discuss the different options of hardware, you know, if they want a rechargeable or a non-rechargeable device.
With the advances that you've mentioned in the different types of devices, remote, rechargeable, if you've had your DBS done, say, 20 years ago, do you get an upgrade? is it important to get an upgrade, or do you generally find that once you have it, that's what a person would stick with?
Yeah, I think as a general rule, I think that's right. I mean, there if you had your implant 20 years ago, we'll be replacing it with a more modern battery that is likely to last longer, and a lot of the time, you know, and you might have the opportunity to have a rechargeable battery as your next replacement. The battery might be a bit smaller. There's a few, you know, the handheld controller that you use as a patient that connects to your device might be a bit more modern and might change accordingly. We wouldn't routinely change the electrode positions in the brain. We're really just changing the battery, and so you use the word stuck, not me, but you are left with the same hardware in the brain, unless you do a further operation, which wouldn't routinely do as part of it. I think if you're 20 years in and your DBS system is still giving you some benefit, I think that's a really good result all around.
That was going to be my next question. As you have DBS, over time, does its effectiveness wear off, or is it simply a matter of recharging it, reprogramming it to meet changed circumstances, so to speak?
One of the things that we try and get over to patients is that DBS is a it's not a cure. It doesn't change the pathology of the or disease progression, and you are trying to ameliorate certain symptoms that they have in Parkinson's disease, but their underlying Parkinson's disease is getting worse. And so there are patients who have on-off fluctuations, but don't have falls, and their cognition is fine at the time that they have surgery. But 10 years down the line, they might still have some benefit from the DBS in terms of their motor fluctuations. But they may have developed symptoms that are unlikely to respond to DBS, and that's related to their underlying Parkinson's. And that might be problems with their speech, swallowing, with their thinking and memory, with their balance and falls as well. And really, Parkinson's, we know that DBS doesn't improve those symptoms. And so whilst we try and counsel patients what to expect and what not to expect with surgery, and explain that there will be some symptoms going forward that the DBS is unable to impact. Having said that, there are occasionally we find that there are some stimulation related side effects that people are experiencing. It's really important for us to recognize when it's a DBS system problem that's going on, and we'll do that. And so we will meet everyone who has a DBS system in. We try and see them at least once a year, check their battery, make sure that there's been no kind of changes in terms of the circuitry in the DBS system, and that it's still working okay.
In terms of what you do, it's an operation on your brain. You mentioned that sometimes people are awake, sometimes people are asleep. In general, how do patients react to the prospect of DBS? Do a lot drop off the kind of referral ladder as they hear more about it? Or are us Parkinson's lot quite a courageous lot? Do most people, you know, who are suitable pursue it? Because it sounds like quite an undertaking.
Undoubtedly, it's an undertaking, and I think I've noticed in the time that we've been running a national service, I think that people are better informed about what DBS involves, and what the likely timelines are in terms of the investigations we do, what to expect in the surgery, what to expect in that year following surgery where you're getting programmed and your medications are being altered, and there's lots of hospital visits, and so we're probably seeing so a Parkinson's doctor, whether it's a neurologist or a geriatrician, will see a patient and say, right, I think this patient is suitable for DBS. Now, there'll be, but even before they're referred to us, there'll be some patients who, for whom the concept of having a surgical operation is so horrific that we'll never get that referral. So they're kind of dropping off before we see them. When they're placed on our waiting list, we've got a brilliant administrator, Margaret Reynolds, who sends out links to a kind of video on what the patient should expect from their initial assessment, and they get a booklet to read about DBS, and invariably they're coming to the clinic and they're asking questions about, well, I read about this but I didn't quite understand it, or I've been onto this Facebook group, or I've read about so and so, or someone from my Parkinson's group or community has DBS, and this was their experience, and so they're coming filled with questions about bits of the process. Sometimes I think the reality that you can read about something, or a colleague or friend may have a procedure, and you think, oh, that's something for me. And then the closer that they get to it, they get a bit cold. They do get cold feet, and they think twice. But most of the patients, by the time that we see them and they go through that process, I think that they're well informed enough to decide, this is something that they want to pursue. With a specific issue about whether they're awake or asleep during surgery, now that is something that we'll give patients the option on. We prefer to do awake surgery. There are some patients who think that they just wouldn't cope with the stress of that, and we can do the procedure asleep. And that's something that's something that we discuss at the consent procedure, in a similar way to discussing what types of device that we would we'd want to implant.
I've got an implanted cardiac defibrillator which sits inside my heart and is constantly monitoring what it's doing and adapting what it does depending on what it's reading. Do you envisage that kind of adaptive response coming in deep brain stimulation engineering, I suppose that is?
Yeah, absolutely, and this is something that is that's a hot topic at the minute, and it's something that I guess we're going to learn a little bit more as time goes on. It's not surprising that cardiology and pacemakers and implantable defibrillators they're always a step ahead in neurology. They're the way that more people have had those devices and they're a bit, they've developed them, and obviously you have adaptive technology within the cardiac devices, and that's coming to that's coming to DBS systems. At the minute, it's only one of the manufacturers that has that sensing capability for DBS, and what it does is with the leads, it is able to record, or it uses a technology it refers to as brain sense, which looks at local, what they call local field potentials, and it's found that from lots of long-term recording of these, it's found that there's a certain band of a frequency that correlates with bradykinetic symptoms. And so sensing those, sensing that would have the advantage of creating a closed loop or an adaptive system where the stimulation is adapted according to what is being read out at the time. And that's a really exciting kind of prospect. And in a number of ways, it would hopefully it would help that initial programming sessions that you do that take ages to get the right stimulation for you, and you can use that sensing technology to work out where exactly which electrode, which combination to use. But maybe in the long term, it'll have a far bigger effect, where you'll notice that the patient needs slightly different stimulation settings when they go to sleep or when they're sitting and resting, compared to when they're walking up and about or when they're speaking. We're at an early stage in that, in terms of what that means. I don't think there are ongoing studies, but I don't think we're quite at the level that we can turn around and say that this sensing technology has resulted in patients having better outcomes yet. But the technology companies are going to be keen to illustrate that. Patients like the idea of it, and us as clinicians will absolutely be on board to try and see if this is something that's useful. The obvious thing to say is anything that drains the battery a bit more is going to provide, you know, is going to provide a challenge, isn't it? You know, if you that recording, it, you know, we're all about conserving the amount of, particularly in the primary cell devices that we use, the non-rechargeable batteries, that is, and we're all about conserving the output. And I think, you know, we'll need to ensure that isn't a significant drain on battery life as well.
So we're not quite at the stage where we're going to be having apps on our mobile phone controlling our DBS quite yet. We're way off, are we? Yet?
I don't think we're way off. I mean, so firstly, everyone who's got a DBS system in gets a patient controller that connects specifically to their IPG. Now, within certain boundaries, patients can make some alterations to their settings. At the most basic level, they can turn their device on and off. And there are some patients who have tremor where we ask them to switch off at nighttime, actually, because in the long term, it improves their tremor control and they switch it back on in the morning. So patients already have some autonomy over, you know, over their device. Whether it means that, you know, there are some patients where you'll have different programs. So you'll have a program that, for example, say there's a DBS program that is really good for the patient when they're walking, but causes a little bit of slurring of speech. So they might want to, if they're going out, you know, they're going out to walk the dog, they might want to switch onto that program. But then when they come back in with their family or friends and they want to sit around a table and have a chat, then they might go onto a program which has a better side effect profile from a speech point of view, but is less good from a motor point of view. So patients already have some of that, you know, some of that control. But obviously the adaptive technologies and the concept of a closed loop kind of will absolutely give them more opportunities in that regard.
You touched there on that little side effect of possibly a bit of slurring of speech. What are the most common side effects from DBS?
Yeah, okay. It varies quite a lot from patient to patient, and it depends on the lead positions and which bits that you're stimulating. But the side effects could be speech is an obvious one. And probably the biggest problem that we come against. Sometimes we can cause a little bit of dystonia with stimulation, and that can impact on walking. Occasionally, stimulation can worsen your balance. The big thing to say is that what's good about DBS is probably its prime selling point. Is it's reversible, so you just you can switch it off, and those side effects should then go away. And if you are in that first year where we're meeting patients on a fairly regular basis and adjusting their stimulation settings, it is really a question of balancing the beneficial effects from stimulation against the side effects and trying to navigate a path for them.
It's not the only surgical technique. We've heard at Nospring about focused ultrasound. Do you ever see that those two could cross or be used together, or are they entirely different things that do entirely different things?
Okay, we'll come to the crossover in just a second, but it's worthwhile saying that we're really lucky in Scotland that we have access to focused ultrasound through the efforts of Tom Gilbertson in Dundee, and so focused ultrasound has been shown to be effective as a treatment for within tremor disorders, specifically essential tremor, and they mostly do unilateral procedures, and when we do. Our unit work very closely with Tom. We do an MDT where we present the videos and try and work out if a tremor patient is a good candidate for focused ultrasound or a good candidate for deep brain stimulation surgery. The two things are quite different. You know, obviously, DBS, you're inserting hardware. Focused ultrasound, it tends to be a unilateral procedure, and you're effectively in a very clever and smart way, but you're creating a lesion. You're burning a small hole in the thalamus to try and improve tremor on that side. We will discuss these cases, and we collaborate very closely with Dundee. Now, there have been cases where patients have had focused ultrasound and then have gone on to have DBS a period later. I don't know where, I'm not aware of any cases where the reverse has happened, that someone's had DBS and then gone on to have focused ultrasound. I think that would be technically difficult or impossible. So I think at the minute you try to work out which of the which advanced therapy is best for which patient is really the important thing to do. They're going to do some good studies in Parkinson's disease, hopefully over the next 12 months, that look to see whether focused ultrasound is an effective treatment for tremor in Parkinson's disease. And remember, it doesn't have the long term, it doesn't have the hardware issues, it doesn't have the side effects that deep brain stimulation surgery does. So there are pros and cons with both of these things. And in Scotland, we're not wedded to either. We want patients to get the best outcome. We're not selling our wares, and the units are not competing against each other for patients.
Absolutely fascinating. I could have kept you. This could have come a marathon podcast. I think I could have kept on for another hour. But thank you very much indeed. That's absolutely enlightening. Tremendously fascinating.
If I may, I've got a couple of questions, Ed, that I could just ask you.
Of course.
I think one thing you've talked a lot about is the sort of preparing people for DBS, and we've talked a lot about what happens during DBS. What happens after DBS? Because I suppose that equally then, once the DBS is in place, the device is in place, what then happens? Because my understanding, there's a little bit of time, a bit like taking medication, to titrate the optimal frequency, the intensity which the DBS is delivered at. Can you just talk us through how long does that sort of take? And is there anything that people need to do in terms of curtailing their activities during that period of time? Just so people have an idea. And then I'll have one last question, and then I promise I'll let you go.
So patients are usually in for 3 days for the surgical procedure. So we tend to do our theatre on a Monday. So they come in on the Sunday evening, and we take them off their medications because we have to do the surgery with the patient in an off state. The surgery is done on the Monday. The medications are restarted on the Monday kind of evening when the patient comes around from theatre, and they spend Tuesday feeling a little bit washed out, and then hopefully home on the Wednesday. So we then see them about 10 days later. I should say the surgeons see them about 10 days later, check the wounds, both the wounds on the chest behind the ears, and then at the craniotomy sites, make sure that they're clean and for removing the stitches. And then their first programming session isn't until around 5 or 6 weeks after the surgical procedure. And the reason for that is that there is some swelling around whenever you place the lead. There's a bit of swelling that goes around that. We need time for that to settle down. And patients with that in the first couple of weeks after surgery, we see what we call an impact effect, where that swelling improves some of their physical symptoms of Parkinson's disease. After that 2 weeks is up, then they go kind of back to their baseline, and then they haven't got too long to wait before that first programming session. In that first programming session, it's a really long clinical session lasting several hours, where we take each of the electrodes and increase up the stimulation, recording the benefit effects, the side effects, and trying to work out what the initial programming session is. But we leave someone on a low level of stimulation because the brain hasn't had you can't dive in at the levels of stimulation that the patient's going to need in the long term, 6 weeks or after their surgery. It's something you very gradually build up to, and so we leave them at a kind of low level of stimulation. And usually start that process of reducing down the medications at the same time. See them back in another 6 weeks, and then we're looking at probably 5 or 6 visits over that first 12 months. Now, some patients are really quick to program and find a good clinical response to. others take a lot longer. The programming's done a combination of the nurse specialists and neurologists as the team. We also have we have some processes where if something's not working, we'll go back, and we've got these really one of the technological advances that I forgot to tell you about was the was some of our imaging guidance techniques. So we're able to do a CT scan of the DBS system and say exactly where it is in relation to the targets, and that can help us, you know, guide towards using a different electrode or a different contact point and adjust it accordingly. There's also the psychological care that we need to think about with the patients, which is really important too. And I know that we haven't spoken too much about this, but as part of our MDT, we have a brilliant team of neuropsychologists who are involved with assessing the patients pre-surgery to make sure that there isn't any reason that they don't have any cognitive vulnerabilities, or there aren't any mental health concerns that would make surgery or the outcomes a bit more challenging. And the truth is, we do see patients whose mood drops a bit after surgery, and it's important that that our psychologists come in and help in that regard.
So with that, they can go back to doing their normal activities, their normal exercise, all that sort of stuff, you know, within maybe it sounds like 10 days to 2 weeks post-surgery?
Yeah, so we say for the first 6 weeks, we want to see them back before we say that they can go back to driving. The surgeons give them, you know, some practical advice on you know, keeping their wounds clean, not submerging them fully in water like a bath, or going swimming for several weeks. We do advise patients in the long term that there are some activities that we'd rather they don't undertake. I have to say that there's not a big list of this, but kickboxing is out. Anything where they might sort of damage their system. We don't want them to go on roller coasters, because that can, you know, the force can impact on their leads and that kind of stuff. But most after any big surgical procedure, patients are advised to gradually get their activity levels back to normal. And you know, the surgeons and the nurses in particular are really good at sort of advising them on how to do that. In my experience, actually, within 2 or 3 weeks, they probably feel kind of back to their baseline.
Excellent. So it sounds like that's a fantastic, and it really just sees how supportive the multidisciplinary team is in getting these people prepared for the surgery, and then letting the surgeons and yourself do the job. And then afterwards, there's a huge support network just to make sure that everything is falling as you'd expect. Yeah, that seems amazing.